You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Nation is brought to you by Outdoor Edge and their complete lineup of replaceable blade knives, fixed blade knives, and game processing kits. Now, we've all been there before, trying to field dress your wild game with a dull knife. This is where Outdoor Edge really steps in. With the Razor Safe system, you can have a brand new razor sharp blade with just the push of a button. No more dull blades and no more problems processing your wild game. To check out all of the products from Outdoor Edge, visit OutdoorEdge.com. And at checkout, enter the discount code NATION30. That's NATION30 for 30% off of your purchase. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Vortex Optics. It's a crazy episode. We're talking with Jason Reed. He is an outdoor writer. He's an entrepreneur. He is an avid sportsman, avid bow hunter, and just an all-around good guy. And he sold his first article for $100 or $150 when he was 19 years old. He's 29 now, so he has 10 years of outdoor writing experience. And he talks to us about how content has changed throughout the course of those 10 years, but at the same time, how experience in the woods has helped him become a better writer, and vice versa, how his writing has helped him become a better hunter. We talk about hunting strategy. We talk, it's a really good BS session that's a little bit different from the other BS sessions that we do, and I know you guys are going to enjoy it. So, that's all I'm going to say about today's episode. Now, with that said, we got to do some commercials here. And first one, I've already mentioned that I got my trail cameras set up. I got some cell cams set up, and we can just kind of ease this transition into Exodus trail cameras, because right now, July 21st to August 11th is Velvet Fest. Right, they do this every year. You send in pictures and tag Velvet Fest on all the pictures that you post of velvet deer. And these guys are doing a ton of prizes. It says use the Velvet Fest hashtag on social to win prizes throughout the online event. We'll be sending out custom shirts to random people that participate. So there is a whole bunch. Oh, look at here. $1,000 gift card from Exodus. So, you can buy $1,000 worth of trail cameras, and they have a whole bunch of different scratch cards that if you order a camera within this range, this July 21st to August 11th range, that you can get a scratch off ticket. And these scratch off tickets range from $25 off to $60 off a camera. And you could potentially win a $1,000 gift card and a t-shirt, a whole bunch of other stuff. So, it's an awesome time to buy an Exodus trail camera. And like I say, every time I talk about Exodus, why do I like using Exodus? I turn them on and they work, period. Like, that's it, right? That's what I want from a trail camera. For me, it's very simple, right? There's a whole bunch of other complex mumbo jumbo that the company takes care of. I don't really care about that. I just want my trail camera to take pictures when I'm not there. And Exodus does that. And they have a 5-year no BS warranty. Go to their website to find out more about that. So there's ExodusOutdoorGear.com. They have, right now, I think they have 3 different types of cameras. One of them is a cell cam. And they have a solar panel as well that I think goes with all 3 of them. So that was ExodusOutdoorGear.com. Now let's go to Ozonix. Dude, Ozonix, right? So I'm gonna say, oh, you don't need Ozonix to go out and hunt. And guess what? You don't. You don't need an Ozonix to go out and be successful in the woods. But I'm telling you what, of all the shit that we buy as for gear as hunters, right? There's a lot of it that is not necessary to kill deer. But for the amount of one of their units, you can buy one of their units. You don't need, like, I'm a firm believer in, you don't need things like camouflage, and you don't need things like crazy expensive camouflage or crazy expensive gear, right? But what Ozonix actually does that has science behind it is that ozone in the air distorts your scent cone, and it makes the deer think that you're, I don't know, further away, or it confuses their brain, or it overwhelms their olfactory, right? So it does all these different things to your scent profile that makes them not crazy and blow and run away, right? It allows them to, sometimes the reaction is their nose goes up in the air and they sniff around and they're like, yeah, whatever, it's not dangerous, I'm gonna just keep going. Sometimes they get curious, and sometimes, hell, they may not even like it, but guess what they don't do? They don't blow, and they don't ruin your entire hunt. And that's why I like the in-the-field use, the functionality of Ozonix. But my favorite is the ozone application outside in their closet and in their dry wash bags. Hang my clothes up, I could be sweating my balls off in the timber on a hot hunt. It stinks like sweat and BO. Hang it in there, run a dry wash cycle. I pull it out the next morning or the next afternoon, and it's clean as a whistle. No scent. And there's times after I run a dry wash cycle before I go into an afternoon or a morning hunt, and I can feel myself clean. Like, I can feel my clothes are clean, and I feel like I'm invisible going into the woods. So ozonixhunting.com, go and check out the all the different units that they have, all the different accessories. They have package deals available as well. And where did I put that? Ozonix has a discount code, NFC21. When you purchase one of their units, you get a free dry wash bag. So NFC21, take advantage of that. And last but not least, no, I got two more yet. We got Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands. Dude, I'm not even going to waste a lot of time here. You know I love Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands. LoneWolfHuntingProducts.com. I'm a huge fan of the four sticks that hang on. It's American-made mobile hunting gear, right? Their hang-ons are able to balance in a tree. You can balance the platform and balance your seat, even on a crooked tree. So it allows you to get in any tree and be comfortable and be quiet while you're setting it up. It's just, dude, it's like an appendage to me. So I think everybody needs to go to LoneWolfHuntingProducts.com. Take a look at all the things that they offer. And while you're there, enter the discount code. You just decide to buy 9FC21, and you can get $50 off of all purchases over $200. So take a look at their Alpha, take a look at their Assault, the sticks. They even have a climber. So 9FC21, $50 off all orders over $200. And that's a really good discount. So there's that. And last but not least, Excalibur, my brain is mush already. Excalibur crossbows. Now, if you're a crossbow guy, I would say look no further than Excalibur. They've been in the game for a very long time. And with time in the game comes people who know what the hell they're talking about, right? And the people over at Excalibur are very knowledgeable when it comes to crossbows. They have a ton of knowledge behind their design. They have a ton of experience behind their design. They have great materials. If you actually want to hear somebody talk about it, go to the Hunting Gear podcast, and you can listen to the guys from Excalibur talk about, you know, the ins and outs of crossbows. Now, I can't use one here in Iowa, so I have to use a compound bow, and I love compound bow hunting. But if you got a kid that wants to get started, or if you're just looking for a little bit shorter of a learning curve, I think a crossbow could definitely be for you. So check out ExcaliburCrossbows.com. Again, badass bows made by badass people from badass materials. And you should check out some of their videos they have online where they drop it off of a water tower, they drag it behind a truck, they put a bolt in it, they shoot it, and it's just still dead nuts center. So take that into consideration too. All right, we've done the commercials. Let's go ahead and get right into today's episode with Jason Reed. 3, 2, 1. All right, on the phone with me today, Mr. Jason Reed. Jason, what's up, man?
Oh, we're hanging in there, man. Just a beautiful day here in upstate New York. In between doing some work and shooting my bow.
Yeah?
Doing pretty good.
So you live upstate New York. Are you on the, what lake is that up there that borders the northern New York?
So I live right on Lake Ontario. I grew up probably about 5 miles from Lake Ontario. And actually, interestingly enough, the county I grew up in is the second largest apple producing county in the nation, right behind Washington. And so everyone I knew growing up, everyone owned an apple farm. Just a lot of really good agriculture because you're really on this floodplain that just has some super, super rich soil.
Yeah.
So you do tend to get some more Midwest like looking deer up in this region as compared to further south where our cabin is.
Yeah. Did you ever grow up hunting apple orchards at all?
Yeah, hunted in and around apple orchards all the time. Actually, my very first buck was feeding underneath kind of an abandoned apple tree, and I was 15. And they just had his head up in the tree, and which was cool about that was, like, I had watched my dad take a lot of deer out of that stand as a kid. Hunting in and around apple orchards, finding abandoned apple orchards, or even, you know, commercial apple orchards, was just very, if you could get near one of those, especially in, you know, early to mid-October, I mean, you were going to see a lot of deer.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so what do you do for a living?
So what I do for a living is kind of interesting. I'm an entrepreneur. I have a couple of small e-commerce businesses, but I've also, you know, that mostly deal with pet supplies, pet nutrition, but I've also been in the outdoor industry for 10 years. I've worked as a writer, a content producer, in and around the industry for a long time. Sold my first article when I was 19. When I was in college, and I honestly, like, my junior and senior year in college, I was filling my gas tank with blogging money, and, you know, I remember selling my first print article, and my writing professor was kind of, she couldn't believe it because I wasn't a writing major, but I figured out how to sell articles, and I'm really a communicator. I love being able to get on the phone with people and find solutions and find sales opportunities. And I figured out how to sell articles, and I sold this article about turkey hunting. And it was just really funny the day that I showed up with a print article and a $150 check, and just, the class couldn't believe it. I've worked in a lot of different industries though. And right now I'm actually also working as a bartender, nights and weekends. It's kind of fun, a little bit change of pace. So just, I've been involved in startup businesses for the last 5 years, while also being a freelance writer and producer. So I do a little bit of everything, and, just trying to make my way in the world and
doing what I can,
because I get this weird thing about me where I really don't like being told what to do during hunting season.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard for me.
That's a fact, man.
I'm willing to take the pain, right? I mean, especially when you're entrepreneurial, I mean, there's a certain amount of pain that comes with that, and I'm willing to go through that because, you know, you, me, and your listeners well know there are certain days you have to be there. And there's nothing worse than when somebody else that doesn't understand hunting or understand the calendar is in control of your vacation schedule. So it's not always the easiest road, but you know, look, as a bow hunter, and I've said this to other people too, it's like, as a bow hunter, like, we are trained for very difficult situations. So what might be difficult and overwhelming to some people, I feel like as bow hunting has really conditioned the business side of my brain as well to be able to really take on challenges and not be overwhelmed by that.
Yeah.
The
analytical thinking and the of the process that goes into it. And I think that's one thing that my wife absolutely hates about me is I'm pretty analytical about my thought, right, my thought process when it comes to like how the household should be run and how how the finances, you know, should be budgeted and stuff like that. And then I'm the same exact way when it comes to the woods. Like, I'm thinking about every step and I correct myself and all this stuff. And, you know, it can be tough, especially I'll just share this. Are you married? Do you have any kids?
No, I'm not married.
Okay. Well, then maybe I won't share that. So you're a free man at this point. Like, you can go and do whatever you want, whenever you want, no problems.
And that's why I buy an elk tag every year. And been buying mule deer tags every year, because there'll be some day where that can't happen.
Yeah. How old are you?
Take advantage of it. I'm 29.
Okay, 29. All right. Yeah, I was still wild at 29, and wild and free, I guess you would say. But so riding. I want to talk about riding. So it was roughly 10 years ago when you sold your first article. When it comes to writing these days, you know, everybody wants to get their foot in the door when it comes to the hunting industry. Right? Everybody wants to mix their passion and pleasure and business. Everybody wants that. Yep. When it comes to writing, in your opinion, how has being a outdoor writer changed in the last 10 years?
Oh gosh, I think I can. I think I can speak to it in a couple of ways, and maybe other writers and other colleagues in the industry might have a different view of it. But this is just purely off the base of what I've seen. And I've seen, not in a bad way, just kind of the reality of business and reality of what, you know, where the world is. I've seen a commoditization, frankly, of writing. And so jobs that I used to get paid $500 or $1,000 for five years ago, those same opportunities, you know, I was getting paid, you know, or the offers are substantially less. There was even a fishing article that, you know, some fishing work that came up a couple of weeks ago, and it was like 2 cents a word for 1,500 words. And I'm like, I'm not going to spend my time for $30. You know what I mean? So, I would say that that's been one of the biggest things that, as content, you know, especially with the advance of the digital age, and it's just part of how markets work. But that's one of the biggest things that I've really seen. The other thing that I've seen too, that it really is for anyone that wants to get into it, and other people might be even better off than I am, but because, like, when I started, social media content was still very small. Nobody knew what to do with it. Frankly, there was only a handful of people that really had it figured out. Our mutual buddy, you know, Mark Kenny, he I feel like he had a pretty good grasp on it early on. I remember, you know, talking with him and seeing a lot of his stuff early on, and there was something different about it. And so I think now, like, people are really looking for more of, it's not just a written article. You need to be able to produce good social content. And again, as somebody who came up more as a writer, it's a little, you know, I've done video before, but you got to be more prepared to come with the photos, the videos, and the written stuff, for the brand, let's call it the brand or the publication, to be able to use in their social feeds. Right. So I think that's really the big difference, is just what exactly people are wanting. And then I think, you know, and obviously if you can produce more of what you need from the social side, I think, you know, that payment will change. But those are really kind of the two things, the two big things that I've seen change over the last decade.
Yeah.
So I mean, some people might have a different opinion, and, you know, I love business theory and business discussions, and, you know, happy to hear other people's success stories, but at least that's, you know, what I've seen over the last 10 years.
Yeah. One reason that I stopped writing, because I was writing for a handful of magazines and some blogs and my own blog, and I kind of just got burnt out because everybody, you know, and after running my own, type of blog, you would see that, and it, everybody wants to read the articles about how to kill, you know, like 10 ways to kill a buck during the rut or 10 ways to do scouting. And so what we see is this mass repetition of content. And it may not be word for word repetition, but I'm telling you right now, it's the same article repackaged every year, you know, and retitled and all that stuff. And so when I would bring an article to the table, they would say, yeah, that's awesome, but we need to call it something else and we need to do something else with it. And I'm just like, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that type of content. So I got burnt out from writing the same articles over and over and over again. And I was just like, you know what? I'd rather do this digital podcasting where I can talk about hunting the rut, but I can talk with 30 different people about it and talk to them about their stories and peel back way more layers in a one-on-one interview, whether it's hunting strategy or this person's life, than an article that's just step one, set up a tree stand. Step two, grunt at them, you know, like that kind of, it became boring to me, and I decided, hey, this isn't for me anymore.
Yeah. And to build on that, like, and again, you have, especially when you're talking about a major publication, they've got their people that they really, you know, that are in line before you and me to write that piece, you know, and again, that's, you know, God bless those people who've earned that right. That's right. The 10 ways to hunt a scrape. You guys earned it. I echo your thoughts there. And there's just a lot of other, you know, and that's been the good thing about the way that, you know, content marketing has changed, is that you can have a little more flexibility and own that journey a little more. I'm not the most technical guy in the world, and I probably should have started podcasting 10 years ago, frankly, but I didn't. So, but again, there are ways to do it, and I think my advice to people, and we can get off of business, but the one piece of advice I'd give to people if they want to get into the industry through content, because you can get in on the sales side. Like, that's a whole side of things that I only ever really scratched the surface of. If you want to get in on the marketing side, because, you know, we're all trying to chase the passion, chase freedom in life, et cetera, I implore you to understand the revenue model behind selling content and monetizing content, especially in this industry. So study it. You know, start it as a hobby and try to sell some freelance stuff and really study how you open up that revenue stream for yourself. Because that's one thing I've seen a lot of people not have an understanding of as they, you know, chase it. And I mean, I didn't really have a great understanding when I started as a college kid, but it really became apparent that, you know, you're getting paid through the advertising budget, you know, which is a couple of steps removed from the sale of the product. So,
yeah,
but it can be done. And there's a lot of people that have done it, and it's a great industry to be involved in. So.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, when it comes to content, right?
Mm-hmm.
Content now is deeper than it was 10 years ago. It's deeper than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right? It's gone from just writing to now we have podcasts, we have social media, we have videos, we have, you know, YouTube, and then we have the television side of things. Like, there's all this different varieties of quote unquote content that hunters absorb.
Yep.
And I think as the digital side of things starts to continues to expand, we have a younger generation of content providers, like younger age groups doing it. here's my kind of problem with that. All right. So I'm 40 years old and I really only have about, I mean, I've been hunting since I was 12 years old, right? So that's 38 years of hunting under my belt. I'm not going to say that, I've had experience, you know, I've experienced in that, but there's even 10 years of that where I was just kind of going through motions and not doing anything, whatever. Sure. Right. So I'm going to say that I have right around 20 years of hunting experience. And when I say experience, I mean, I can provide examples. I can talk in detail. I can, you know, do all of these things. Now, when a 20-year-old decides he wants to go on to Instagram and say, hey, here's how you should do this, or here's ways to do this. What are your thoughts on age and an activity like hunting where experience and lots of experience really does matter?
That's a good question. I think what you're seeing a lot of is, almost from an ambassadorship type standpoint, like people that are young, that are creating content hunting, the enthusiasm is awesome. And I think we should welcome it because, mm-hmm. and a lot of times, here's why I say that, because I think with guys like you and me have been doing this for way over 20 years, that sometimes, like, maybe we scare people off. But you have people that are just getting into it. They're maybe 3, 4, 5 years into it, and they're just so excited because they're experiencing these things for the first time, and they're able to talk in a way to somebody who might be a teenager, might be 12, 13 years older, or just coming up through it, maybe interested in it, that they can see this level of enthusiasm that you and I might take for granted. So I think it's a good thing. And look, let's be honest, like it's hunting. Like we're here to have a great time doing it as much as we are intense about it. So if we can show that there's an authenticity surrounding it, then great. Now, is somebody who's 2 years into it going to be able to give you, tell you exactly how to hunt a specific scenario? Maybe not, but they can tell you how they screwed up.
Yeah,
and if they know how to do that, like that's almost as valuable, especially the people that are just getting into it. Whereas, like you and I, we might not even think to talk about a mistake because it's just like they did that again. Darn it.
Yeah,
you know. So I understand what you're saying, and it's like, there's a whole generation. Even like I said, I'm only 29, but there are people that are way better with social media and communicating, using it for communication than I am. So if you can, help spread that message and show the joy in the mistakes, because that's what I've told some other of my friends of mine that are, I'm helping to, mentor through hunting, and they're super timid to go out in the woods and make mistakes. And I'm like, no, go screw up. It's okay. Like go mess up, go blow a deer out. You'll figure that you'll learn.
All right. Let me ask you this. It's more of a statement. My stepbrother found a whole bunch of old magazines from the 50s and 60s. They were all outdoor magazines. They talked about fishing and they talked about hunting strategy and things like that. And they might have even gone into the 70s. This old man, he passed away, but he saved all of his hunting and fishing magazines. And he went through and he started reading some of these articles, and it was crazy, right? About all these things and strategies that, hey, you need to sit on a field edge and wait for the deer to come. And that was pretty much every strategy that anybody ever talked about, or, that kind of stuff. No one back then was doing the detailed stuff that we are, that we talk about now. And, it kind of made me think it was simpler back then, but I think as a content provider, they could get away with a lot more, inaccuracies in their writing than they can today, because there's so much more known about the science behind whitetails and deer movement and all that stuff. And it just kind of caught me funny. And, you know, all the covers, nobody was wearing camouflage. Everybody was wearing flannel way back then. And I don't think people started wearing camo until they got back from some war. And I'm not sure what war it was. I want to say World War II. Everybody got back from war and they started wearing camo. So everything before that, you know, everything before World War II was all just like overalls and stuff. And people seemed to be having the same success. So I don't know. All those things really just are kind of funny and interesting to me.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. I also think that there is a different sense of woodsmanship with the older generations that we may or may not have in today's generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think that's probably part of it. I also think, yeah, science and understanding the science behind animals and animal movements, certainly, you know, part of it. You know, that changes, you know, once we understand things and, you know, and the marketing of hunting products really wasn't the same at that time either. So there wasn't, you know, I think that probably had some to do with it as well, yeah. You know, because it really, you know, back then nobody really cared if you shot a 6-point, you know. Yeah. And you really didn't start to see this, at least in my, you know, and I actually, now that we're talking about it, I actually wrote my entire senior thesis in college about the advancement of communication in the hunting industry. I wrote like, I don't know, something stupid, like 55 pages. And it was only like a 20 page assignment for the thesis. And I was like, 55 pages later, I get an email from my advisor. And I'm like, are you done yet? But, you know, but really, like, when people, I don't, you know, really started to see the tactics of it coming into play when you started to see, you know, the advancements in hunting companies like your Realtors and your Mossy Oaks and people wanting to have that same level of success they saw on TV, not really realizing, like, there's a big difference between upstate New York and Iowa, massive difference, you know. But, you know, I think that probably had something to do with it. So
yeah.
But it's always, you know what though, here's the thing. It's always fun to read those,
read
the perspectives.
Oh yeah.
You know, from the past. And I still think that there's always a lot of value there because it's really a lot of that stuff. I think, you know, though that generation had a better sense of woodsmanship than we do.
Yeah.
And just working with the flow of the woods. And I know some people that are my age that are incredible woodsmen. I mean, incredible. And you're just inspired by every time, like, you're a throwback from some other era, man.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting down, looking at prints, saying, okay, he weighs about 240 pounds and he's walking east. And this morning for breakfast, he had, like 40 acorns, you know, like that kind of woodsmanship, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And just being able to read the land and have an understanding of how the animals really use it. Is one of the biggest differences, and anyone who's young and who's listening to this, that's what I would encourage you to really, try and think about. Is like, okay, how are the deer going to use? How are they using the land?
Yeah.
As you can save yourself a lot of years of pain and struggle if you ask yourself that question.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you this. You said your first article was when you were 19, and your first, did you say your first buck was when you were 15?
Yep. So okay. I shot my first buck when I was 15. Yep.
All right. So you had 4 years of actually killing deer under your belt before you started writing, right? How has your writing changed as your hunting strategy, as you've gained more experience?
That's a great question. So I'll say this, like, I think I explained it when we met at Poma a couple weeks ago. Like, my dad started taking me hunting when I was two. And so I really grew up in the throes of just being, trying to be as close and involved to the strategy as possible. Like, I wanted to be one of the guys. There was a lot of things that changed between when I was 15 and when I was 19, because it's a whole different world when you actually sit with a gun or a bow. I think what's really changed, I think my questions when I'm trying to, interview somebody have just become better. But I'll be honest with you, a lot of the articles that I've written, I've done a lot of stuff with, reviewing products. I've done a lot of, just general interviewing stories, and not just for deer hunting. I've interviewed sports stars, people from all over the world that, some of these trade shows. So I think just really trying to ask better questions, and that kind of parlays into being, having worked in sales in different roles, is like you really learn how to ask better questions to flip over some nugget of knowledge. And so I think between the time I was 19 and now, my grammar's definitely got a whole heck of a lot better. I've got freaking scars down my back from editors yelling at me and whatnot. But I think that's really what is just trying to learn, understanding how to ask better questions to somebody. Sometimes with an article too, like you feel like, and I remember this as a kid, I remember in those first couple of years, like I tried to make an article all things, right? And so just like, you can make 800 words out of a single thing, as long as you follow, build your questions out ahead of time and go and execute on that.
Yeah. Yeah. The more you know, the more you know, basically. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you can flip a statement into a question real easy. And that's where, I don't want to pat myself on my own back, but I think that's one thing that I'm fairly good at in mine, is having experience to back up the question and being able to peel back an additional layer of information. Like when you ask someone why you did something, but then like, well, why did you do that? Then why did you do that? Like being able to go multiple levels deep. And when someone can do that based off the experiences that they've had, man, that just makes whatever they're doing really good.
Well, especially when you think about in terms of teaching new hunters, younger hunters, being able to bring in that scenario, that is a real life scenario to help with their question, makes teaching so much more valuable to them.
Yeah.
And that is like, I've got friends that are 2-3 years into this thing, and they ask a question, I'm telling a story in order to help them understand, why we're doing what we're doing and why we're approaching something the way we're approaching it. Because it's not even hunting, even doing something for the sake of doing something. It's why are we going to approach it from this angle?
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely, man. All right. So, a lot of outdoor riding, a lot of experience in the content, but was there a time where maybe you were struggling as a hunter, and then all of a sudden you had like, I always like to hear people's aha moments, whether it's one aha moment, like you're in the woods and you're going, it just clicks for you that year. And you're just like, oh my God, how did I not realize I was doing this specific thing wrong for all those years? And I screwed up and now I figured it out. And then it became, I guess, easier for you. Was yours one big aha moment, or did you have several aha moments?
I think it's always a lot of little aha moments that are actually big, because you're always building that you're always building those questions you had, and you're falling back on the experience. You know what I mean? But to answer that question very specifically, I did have a fairly large aha moment, because from the time I was 17 to the time I was 21, I'd only shot 2 bucks, and one of them was a massive buck, and I can tell that story later. But what I was doing, I was getting really fed. I would shoot does, you know what I mean? But I was watching one of my best friends in the world. He was shooting 5-6 deer a year off the ground with his bow. And I was like, I was really struggling. And the guy I referenced was a really good woodsman. And what I realized what I was doing wrong was I was looking at the woods too big. I was looking way too broad. I was thinking about a ridge line. I was thinking about the whole ridge line. You know what I mean? I wasn't thinking about my pinch point. Why am I hunting this spot? And so there was always this book floating around our house called Mapping Trophy Bucks by Brad, I can't remember his last name, Brad Hendon. But it basically talks about talking or hunting topographical lines. And that's when the wheels really started to turn. And then when I got back to going elk hunting, and that's what you're really relying on is topo lines and your GPS, that's when everything changed for me, because then I started to look at the world a lot smaller. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that my encounter percentage of quality deer in bow range has, over the last, probably at least 7 years, has just skyrocketed. Because now I'm looking at, I will go in completely blind. I lived in Missouri for 3 years. I didn't have any private land at all. All I had was public and my climber. And I was consistently getting in bow range, walking in sometimes completely in the dark, blind, consistently getting into bow range because I was looking at the world differently instead of looking super broad. And I think that's the one thing that changed between my, teens and early 20s as I'm going into my, into my 30s here is just looking at trying to break down the world a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And I could tell you with absolute certainty that was really my light bulb moment, was trying to just don't look so big, look small.
Yeah, man, that's some great advice that a lot of people, man, that was the problem that I had when I was younger. I was like, hey man, I need to knock on the farmers. I'd go to the courthouse. I'd get a plat book for like $3. And I would sit there and I would go, you know what? I got to find the guy who owns the 1,000 acres and I need to knock on his door, or the guy who owns the 800 acres and knock on his door. Well, I learned really fast that all those places had people hunting already. So I would drop down to the 20s, the 40s, and I'm there, I'm on these 20s and 40s, maybe an 80 piece or an 80 acre piece or whatever. And guess what? They still have deer running in those places too, right? There's a 90 acre piece that is by far one of the best properties that I've ever hunted in my entire life. And it was only this 90 acres with 3 little fingers in it. And majority of it was CRP field. And I ran into some of the biggest deer in my life in this little acreage. It's since been sold and moved on, and I don't have permission on that piece anymore. But I was able on those to really focus on those 3 fingers, because I'm not going to hunt in the middle of a CRP field, right? So it kind of forced me to think at a much smaller scale, like the deer are coming out of here and they're going into here. And I have to be on that line somewhere, right? Somewhere, whether it's close to their bedding or close to the destination food source or on a pinch point. And it made me hyper focus on these terrain features and wind direction, and allowed me to be, forced me basically to be more observant. And that is what just happened with you, man. I started getting encounters with more deer and bigger deer and more mature bucks. And that's all that kind of snowballed into where I'm at today.
Yeah, it's a powerful place to be once you really start reading those topo lines.
Yeah.
And when you have that realization, that just because you might be on 15 acres doesn't mean you're not hunting hard.
Yeah.
Because take it from me. My biggest turkey came off of 3 acres and my biggest buck came off of 15.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that's what I encourage young guys to do is know how to read your topo lines and get a climber.
Yeah.
You know, and be mobile.
Yeah.
So you can just adjust until you figure out what's working.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So, that was one of your aha moments. When it comes to deer behavior, you know, like there's this, when you win a championship, they say, act like you've been there before, right? In the moment of truth, you got to act like you've been there before. Right. And there's been times where I have not acted like I've been there before. The excitement got the best of me and I missed a shot, or I put a bad shot on a deer, or I overcalled or, froze and didn't do anything when I may have had a shot opportunity there, you know, all those bad worst case scenarios. Do you have any type of those experiences where you were, I don't know, you failed, but then you realized you failed and then you turned around and then came back from that and ended up getting the job done?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There was, all right. So one time,
I love that you're laughing at this point. Like you're laughing because you're about to embarrass yourself.
Dan, it's not one time. It's like, okay, which one?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think that's the great thing is it's like, and that's a great thing I try to tell younger hunters. It's like just enjoy screwing up. Like it's frustrating in the moment, but you're gonna just cherish each failure because it's not a failure. It's really not. So one of the times that I screwed up really bad, and it was one of those weird Indian summer weather stretches in November. It was like 70 degrees. And where I used to work, I used to work out for this industrial ingredients company. So I could hunt in the mornings. I could hunt the shoulders of the day. And frankly, that's how I do most of my hunting anyways. First 2 hours before work, 2 hours afterward. And I just remember like I was struggling to see deer because it was so hot. And I had found this, kind of by accident, kind of by reading a topo map, there was some little feature. I remember on the line, I'm like, I need to walk to the very back line of this piece I have permission on and just check it out. And found this overgrown swamp and it was crazy. Like I saw, you're not supposed to hunt your spot like every day. Like I know that's kind of taboo. There was new deer in this thing every single day during the peak of the rut. It was crazy. But I do remember at one point I saw this doe coming my way. And behind her is a beautiful 10-point. And I must have been, crap. I was 22, maybe. And so I should have just not done anything, and they probably would have walked by me. I hit my can thinking like, oh, I got to get his attention and try to draw him this way. And that doe looked at me 70 yards away and was like, I'm going the other direction. And took that buck with her. So it's really tempting to pick up your call when you see a deer. I've come to learn, like, be easy on it. It's got to be the right situation.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that. And in that particular situation, I'm like, I'm not doing that again. If their movement is in my general direction, keep your hand on your bow.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what other.
I'll share a quick one. Sure. I'll share a quick one with you.
Yeah, go for it.
It was back in the day when I was filming for White Knuckle Productions, and the night before I had a giant on this ridgetop. I was hunting a river bottom and I saw him up on this ridgetop, and I was like, okay, he's heading that way. I'm gonna go hunt this. This place where I know they're standing corn still, and it was mid November. And so we're sitting there and all of a sudden we see this deer creeping through the woods. There'd been a couple other does that had come by us, and they were walking right underneath of me. So I had one of these great thermal situations where I had a south wind and thermals, and the deer were actually coming to the north side of me, but the thermals were pulling the scent up and just coasting it way out into the field. Well, all these deer all afternoon are just cruising right in front of me. And then we see in the timber, we see this deer heading our way, pops out. It's like a 180 12 pointer. Just an absolute giant animal. And it's coming right for me. And it stops dead in its tracks. And it was that point right there where old Dan Johnson was like, oh God, he caught something. He caught the scent. Cause I think what happened is, well, number one, my Ozonics batteries had died in that long sit and I didn't have any ozone going in the air. Number two, the thermals had changed because the sun had since gone behind the trees and everything was in shade now. So my thermals were kind of dropping. So it could have been a combination of a lot of things. Anyway, that buck ended up freezing. I mean, the video shows him basically hitting a brick wall and he stops and he instantly starts turning around. So what did I do? I just went through every sequence of calling. I did the one. I did the rattling sequence. I did the tending deer.
Snort wheezed
at him. I did everything. And this buck was looking around like, what the hell is going on? He was probably about 50 yards. It was crazy. And that was the last time I have ever called at a deer that I know has busted me. So, it's just that type of learning experience that you pick up. And sometimes those learning experiences hurt just a little bit more than others.
Oh yeah. You know what though? For anyone that's young that's listening, you're going to take that, you're going to put it in your repertoire of questions you're going to ask yourself. And you're going to get to a point, especially if you're paying attention to the questions you need to be asking yourself, you're going to get to a point where you're able to size up a day, a time, and a scenario, and you're going to be able to get yourself into a situation, into a good situation. That's where it kind of becomes fun once you've been doing this for so long. It's like, because you're asking yourself these really, although they seem like minor questions, but that's where your brain is going. It's how your brain is moving and spinning. It's always fun to evolve as a deer hunter. That's for sure.
Yeah. So New York is kind of where you cut your teeth at. Where else have you spent a lot of time hunting?
Yeah. So, and when I talk about New York, like I said, grew up on the lake shore, so you have big agriculture. But my primary, the piece of land that really shaped me to be who I am is right on the border of Pennsylvania and New York, and so that's massive woods, big blocks of timber, big Appalachian type hunting. And so when I lived in Missouri for 3 years, and that was wild because, I just having the volume of deer that I saw it was just a treat. I didn't know what to do with myself sometimes. I'm like, this is just awesome. any average buck that steps out and you're like, oh, well, if I were back home in New York, I'd probably shoot you right now. So I spent 3 years there. I mean, I just saw some beautiful deer. But I've also spent, most of my time, my out of state hunting has actually been for elk. Been really, really blessed that I have a chance to, some really good friends that, live in Oregon. And, we've been, my dad's been hunting out there for, since the early 2000s. Once I graduated college, I was like, you're not going without me. So I would say, that's probably where I've spent the lion's share of my, extra time and money is going on that trip. And that trip has made me a better deer hunter, because it's forced me to learn how to read topography better. But I did get into, mule deer hunting a couple of years ago, done rifle hunts, some bow hunts, and even though it's not whitetails, it still teaches you little things about animals and forces you to become a better bow hunter. So I'd like to hunt more in other places. That's why I'm trying to build my own company so I can go and do that.
So Pennsylvania, New York, you've dabbed into the mule deer side of things as well. Any other states outside of those?
I've hunted the other places I've hunted. Hunted in Texas a couple of times, on some, used to do some work with, some folks in the industry. And so I got to go down and hunt down there for whitetails. That was an interesting experience. But that's really it. Haven't hunted really anywhere else for whitetail. And then out west, just been Oregon and Dakotas have been my only other places. So, I feel like, you know, once you get those instincts down, you can go just about anywhere, especially for whitetails, and be able to make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, that's where I'm aiming myself to be right now. So I definitely want to kill a mule deer. I definitely want to kill whitetails, elk. Those two are next on my bucket list, so to speak. I haven't crossed the whitetail boundary yet. I'm still, you know, I'm still in the whitetail world, but I want to kill a mule deer buck so bad, and I want to kill a bull elk so bad. Those are two things that I'm really focused on in the next 5 years per se.
It's magical.
That and spreading my wings in the whitetail game, like hunting different states, hunting big woods, hunting flatland, you know, or not the same as Iowa. And honestly, Iowa has a couple different options when it comes to, like, Iowa in the northeast section of the state along the Mississippi River. There's a lot of big woods up in there as well. Not like the UP of Michigan or northern Wisconsin or, northern, some of the other northern states. And also I want to kind of try Nebraska on for size again, where it's wide open, whitetail type hunting as well. So, and I'm a firm believer that, yes, every scenario is different, right? So for me coming from Iowa, trying to give anybody advice who hunts big woods in Ohio or Pennsylvania or New York or whatever, there might not be a direct correlation, but I feel that the principles of how deer operate and how they make their decisions are more on the same than they are different, if that makes sense.
No, they definitely are. And I think the one thing to even build on that, this is going back to those aha moments, to build on this point is, the principles of deer hunting don't change too much. But one of the things I had to do is I had to adjust my expectations for the types of land I was hunting.
Absolutely.
And that increased my joy in hunting tenfold, because I didn't realize that all these TV shows on the Outdoor Channel were coming from the Midwest. Like, and so I was, there's a reason why I shot 2 bucks in 8 years when I was younger, because I was waiting. Paid off after a while, but that was the biggest deer I've ever seen. It took half a lifetime of hunting to get there. But once I started hunting the land I was hunting for what the land was worth, oh my gosh, you just, all that pressure goes away. And then you're just focusing on what is the value of this hunt? Well, you got yourself in a position, you made a game plan, you executed the game plan, and you punched a tag, or you've gotten bow range. And my dad and I will do this to each other every year. We're like, all right, so how many catch and release do you have this year? Oh, I'm at 15. How many do you have? So just enjoying where you're at and the land you're at is just, if you're not doing that, then you're missing the principles of hunting.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, Jason, man, hey, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to just sit here and BS with me for a while. We'll have to have you on again, later. Absolutely. And BS about a little bit more strategy type talk, because I know you were really wanting to get into that today. We just kind of skimmed the surface on that. And so, again, man, thank you for your time.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody, before I get into all of the other type of you know, all of the other type of outro here. I just want to say thank you. It means a lot to me that you guys are continuously downloading and listening to the Nine Finger Chronicles, man. Really appreciate it. Tell your friends about it. Okay. So I don't have a very search engine optimized name that doesn't have the word hunt or bow hunt in it. And that could be my fault, but I'll tell you this, the content that you're going to listen to on this podcast is second to none, in my opinion. That may be me being arrogant, but I feel that the average Joes telling their stories have a lot to offer the other people who listen to this podcast. So you know, share it, tell your friends, make some posts, tag us in your social post on Instagram. Whenever you're listening to this, tag the Nine Finger Chronicles and on Instagram and Facebook, and let's grow this community even more than what it's already grown. So first off, thank you. Second, huge shout out to all the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and that is Ozonix, that is Lone Wolf, Exodus, Excalibur, Wasp, Vortex, and Hunt Stand. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast. Be sure you're following on Instagram and Facebook and the YouTube channel, right? So we got to follow on the YouTube channel. And other than that, on the Sportsman's Nation YouTube channel, that's where the Nine Finger Kitchen is coming out. And then last but not least, man, be kind to your neighbor. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Wear your tree harness, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.